Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy using your member number at the snack bar, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at CLT underscore golf guy, and I know I'm not the first, but let me be the latest to wish you a happy Thanksgiving on this weekend. You know, among the many things I'm thankful for is the opportunity to talk to so many interesting people in and around this game that we love. And as such, today we celebrate with a couple of my favorite recent conversations. David Woosley is a frequent guest on the show and has been a caddy on tour for more than three decades. Currently, he's on the bag for one of the best up-and-coming players in the world, Sam Burns. But we begin today with a two-part conversation I had last year with Jack Nicklaus II, Jackie, most famous for being on the bag with his father at that historic 1986 Masters, but is an accomplished golf architect and player in his own right. Jack, I'm going to start with a question that I'm betting no one has asked you, or at least not asked you recently. How young were you when you realized how special Barbara Nicklaus is?
Well, you threw me off. I thought you were going to ask me about Jack Nicklaus. Good for you. Gosh, you did catch me off guard with that. You know what? I can answer it in a number of different ways, but I'm still realizing what a wonderful lady Barbara Nicklaus is. She's doing so much today. For the Nicklaus Children's Hospital and here during the Memorial Tournament this week for the Nationwide Children's Hospital. And, she dedicates her time to helping people. She's so kind always to everybody. Doesn't matter who it is or where they're from. She is just complete kindness and just wants to help. Her memory is insane. She remembers details about people that, when I have a tough time remembering a first name, she remembers full names, children, grandchildren's names. I mean, and she keeps in touch with everybody. I can go on and on, but I will say this. There's no question my dad's career would not have been what it has been without my mom supporting him. She kept everything in order in his life. She managed us kids, managed the household. There's no question that without her support, there wouldn't have been the career that Jack Nicklaus has had.
Seriously, though, you're the first of your parents' five children. Do you remember when it might have occurred to you that people didn't treat your dad or your family the same ways that other people's families were treated? At what point in your life did it become apparent to you that I'm in sort of a different situation here?
Well, I think my mom and dad, I'm not going to say sheltered us from that, but they did not thrust us out in the limelight. They kept us very grounded. And they taught us good principles and fundamentals and good morals. It's just, my dad was in the public eye, but I can go back to some. Little things that I said, someone apparently, I don't remember, but apparently I said when I was about 6 years old, when asked, what does your dad do for work? And my response was, oh, he doesn't work. He just plays golf. And, it was never a big deal. At least mom and dad never made it a big deal. And they were always at all of our sporting events. And honestly, we didn't see ourselves as any different than anybody else.
I'm glad you brought that up, because this is something that I've always admired from afar. The priority that your parents made of being parents. In fact, I remember watching your nephew play at FSU a few years ago in bowl games and seeing your folks in the crowd. And they looked so satisfied and so comfortable in the role of just being Nick O'Leary's grandparents. And I was trying to think how to put this. Arnold Palmer always wanted to be recognized as Arnold Palmer. And that's not a bad thing. And that's not a knock on Arnold. But am I correct in saying that when your parents would show up at your ball game or at a recital for your sister or at Nick O'Leary's football games, they were more than happy and content in the skin of just being mom and dad or grandparents.
I think that's a really accurate statement. You know, Arnold, I love Arnold Palmer, and he's so dearly missed. But I think Arnold was really comfortable in a room of 500 people that he hadn't met. They were soon going to be his friends. And I think my mom and dad would more gravitate to smaller groups and maybe a more intimate setting. You know, everyone's wired a little bit differently. But Arnold and my dad, boy, they had an amazing friendship over the years. But to get back to the role of grandparents and parents, they have completely embraced that. Yeah, he was at Nick O'Leary's. My mom and dad were at Nick O'Leary's events. In fact, I don't know that they missed a single college football game,
wow,
home or away, in the 4 years that Nick was at Florida State. They're at Buffalo Bills a lot, watching him play. But that's one of 22 grandkids. My mom and dad often have to split their time up, mom going one direction, dad the other, so they can attend all the kids' games. I mean, that has become, not become, it's always been a priority for mom and dad. And it was the same way when we were growing up. I cannot recall many events that mom and dad missed. Mom was our scorekeeper in our basketball games. Dad was often on the roof of the gym overlooking the football field, you know, calling down plays to our coach. I mean, they were very involved with our lives. And I can remember our football team. My brother Steve and I were playing out west of Lake Okeechobee against our crosstown rival. And you know, it's a very difficult place to get to. That was a Friday night game. My dad was playing the World Series of Golf up in Akron, Ohio, and he played his round. He was lucky enough to play that morning. Got on a plane, flew down into this remote area west of Lake Okeechobee, got to our game before kickoff, wished us good luck, watched our game. I will mention we won the game. And he slapped us on the butts, said, nice game, we'll see you guys Sunday night. Got on the plane, flew back to Akron. I'm sure he got back at, you know, 2 in the morning. And I wish I could tell you he won the tournament, but I don't think he did that year. But that's the type of sacrifices that that they've made for us that really – have made an impact in our lives, and you know, such a great role model for myself as a parent.
Jack Nicklaus II is our guest, taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. I want to ask about your sister just for a second, Nick O'Leary's mom. You have three brothers and you have a sister. And I would think, even in an age, and I think you were really lucky in that you grew up when you did, I think it would be so tough to be Jack Nicklaus's kid right now with social media and with the constant scrutiny and the 24-hour golf channels. I think the pressure would be immense. I'm not saying it wasn't pressure-filled. But your sister had it a lot easier from a pressure standpoint being Jack Nicklaus's daughter than you guys did being Jack Nicklaus's sons. Is that correct?
Well, I think we all... we all had our own experiences. I think there's a lot of positives and there's some negatives. You know, when it comes right down to it, we all had great parents, and we're lucky we still have great parents. Nan has done a great job with her five kids. She played sports. Matter of fact, she probably had the best golf swing of any of my siblings, but she just never really played. She played volleyball at the University of Georgia, and my parents went and watched her play there, like she did with all of us. I don't know that I'd say she had it easier or tougher. I think we're all in kind of the same boat, and we've all been very supportive of each other.
Speaking of your playing career, and I guess I had sort of forgotten. For those that may have forgotten like me, Jack Nicklaus II had a hell of an amateur career. Like his father, he won the North-South Amateur, which to me, look, there's the U.S. Amateur and there's the North-South Amateur. That's how much I think of that tournament. And you won it in 1985, but I was looking at the years surrounding 1985. Listen to some of these names that put their name on that trophy. Hal Sutton, Corey Pavin, Keith Clearwater, Davis Love III, Jack Nicklaus II, Billy Andrade. That's six or seven names out of 8 years. That's a heck of a time in amateur golf in this country, huh?
Oh, I I had a really lucky week. It was so much
fun.
I had so much fun. It was kind of neat. My dad was on his way to the Memorial Tournament, which in fact we're playing this week, and so he's on his way up. I'm sure he thought that I'd, you know, maybe not qualify for match play, and I did. And I think he probably thought I'd maybe get beat in the first round, and I won the first round. And what happened, he eventually ran out of clothes. He called my mom each night. He says, "Well, Jackie won again today, and I'm going to have to get some more clothes." And I think by the week's end, he had no anticipation of being there, you know, through the finals. And, of course, he was there. He watched every shot that was played, and I think he was probably worn out by the time he got to the Memorial Tournament. But it was a really fun time and to play college golf and amateur golf. And I feel really blessed that I got to rub shoulders with some of those great players. And, you know, I never had the next career like those guys did. But, you know, I'm probably getting off on tangents. But at the time, you know, Davis Love, we played on the same team in North Carolina. He was a dominant player, but probably the most dominant player that time was Scott Verplank. And Scott was out of Oklahoma State, and you know, he was one of those guys that was so good you just couldn't understand it. And I remember I had won the North South on Sunday, I believe it was, and that night I flew down to Greenleaf near Orlando in Florida to play the NCAAs. And I remember walking on to the tee, and you know, I was always in awe of Scott Verplank, and Oklahoma State was warming up, and Scott stopped his warm-up, turned around, and started clapping for me. And that really meant a lot to me. It still does. I mean, that was just a really nice thing to do for somebody that, you know, was the king of amateur golf at the time, to recognize, you know, me for something that I had done. It was really the first major victory that I had, you know, ever had in amateur golf, really.
Well, Scott Verplank, always known for being a classy guy, and that
he's
story really illustrates it. Jack Nicklaus II is our guest taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. So let me do some timeline work here. If you are the reigning North-South amateur champion in 1985, when you're on the bag in 86, you're still the North-South champion, and you're caddying at the Masters? I mean, at some point, do you not look at your old man and say, get somebody else. I'm the North-South champ, Pop.
Oh, well, I had a chance, had I played a little bit better in the fall of 85, I would have made the Walker Cup, and I would have been playing in the 86 Masters had that happened. I played in the British Amateur later that year, and I got beat in the quarterfinals by David Curry. He ended up winning the tournament, and oddly enough, I saw David Curry at the Masters in 86. So, I think had I made the Sweet 16 at the Western Amateur, that was another hurdle that would have gotten me into the Masters. So rather than playing in the Masters that year, I got to caddy, but boy, what a ride that was in 86.
He's only the son of the greatest of all time and one of my favorite people that I've met in this game, Jack Nicklaus II. Up next, he takes dead aim at that historic caddying job at the 1986 Masters and more, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Are taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And we continue now with our conversation with Jack Nicklaus II and his historic job caddying for his father at the 1986 Masters. You know, we all remember that, of course, and I really enjoyed the Golf Channel did a tremendous piece on the 30th anniversary last year where we learned a couple of things that I had never heard before. But in the moment, when you were in it, when your dad and you were in it, and after immediately after it was done, did you realize how big it was or how big it was going to become over time?
I didn't realize how big it was going to become, but I knew it was really big at the time. You know, Dad hadn't won for several years. It was my first time caddying for my dad at Augusta. I'd caddied for him many times prior to that. And it was it was a growing significance throughout the week, but particularly on Sunday, you know, a little bit on the front nine, but really on the back nine. When he started gaining some momentum and the crowd really rallied behind him, the applause that he got was just amazing. They embraced him. And it was an embrace, not just for what he was doing that particular Sunday afternoon, but it was, I really felt it was an embrace for what he has meant for to the game of golf, what he's, you know, meant for, you know, so many people as a role model. He embodied so much that is good, that the people, I think they appreciated what he was doing that day, and they appreciated what he had done throughout his career. And there was such a well of emotions as my dad approached every green and every tee. I could see him tear up at every junction, and it was amazing that he could regroup and perform. And, certainly it culminated into, a hug that was very natural on the 18th green that I'll remember forever.
Now, that hug was very public. And then, of course, you have the multiple ceremonies of the green jacket. You have the dinner with the members afterwards. And there's a lot of hoo-ha that goes on after the Masters that no one really knows about. And it's not till later that evening when perhaps you get back to the residence that you guys had rented in Augusta for that day. Or maybe it even came later. That first moment, privately, when it's just you and your dad, what was said?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't know that there was a lot of discussion. I mean, by that time you're exhausted. They put the green coat on. Well, let me back up. You're in the heat of it. You know, I'm just trying to not to screw up as a caddy. My dad's hitting these great golf shots. And he finishes and signs a scorecard, and they take him over to the Jones cabin, which is just to the left of the 10th tee. And it's the first time I'd seen my dad nervous the entire day, because, and my dad explained that to me later. He said he felt like he could control his destiny all day long up until the point where he held out his last putt. At that point, it was out of his hands. He did all that he could do, and he was nervous. And, we had the TV on, and he was kind of pacing back and forth behind the couch in the small room there at the center of the Jones cabin. But, we didn't talk a lot. we were just intent on seeing what was going to happen. And, of course, when Kite missed a close putt and Greg Norman had the pitch out at 18 and missed a putt on the green as well, that's at that moment we knew that Dad had won the Masters, and we all had a great embrace. His sister Marilyn was there, and it was just and his mom and my mom and myself. Just our group was in that room, and it was a great embrace and happiness. And then of course they escorted him right out to meet the crowd and to the cheers, and at that point what happens is they do the coat ceremony, and then there's a small ceremony after that with some of the members, and then frankly we got on an airplane and came back home that night. So we probably got home at 1 or 2 in the morning, so there was probably more sleep than talk.
At that point in your career as a player, you mentioned you were playing in Carolina, you were the North South Amateur Champion. In a private game in South Florida at that point, had you beaten your dad?
Yes. Maybe 1 out of 100 times.
but you had done it. So you could say, hey, I've beaten the Masters champion.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
But again. I learned early on, Charlie, that we played a lot of golf. And my brother Gary and I both learned if we were up on him at all, we might have him 1 or 2 up with a couple holes to play. And every time we brought that to my dad's attention, I'm telling you what, putts went in the hole from all directions. I mean, he had a switch that he could just turn on. So we learned not to bring it up. And occasionally we got to the last hole without him realizing we might have him one up. But again, that was not very often.
Jack Nicklaus II is our guest taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. I know you're involved with the Nicklaus Design Company. You had your own design business for a while, and to me, I think this is a supreme talent. I've never understood. I have friends that can walk into old houses and old architecture and go, if I take this wall out here and do this and this, I can. And I never can see that. And the ability to be able to walk out on an expanse of land, a piece of property, and envision a golf course, I think that's an incredible talent and an incredible vision. Is that something you were born with, or is that something that you were taught by your dad? How did you develop that skill?
You know what? I think it's a learned skill. I've always enjoyed, you know, the artwork part of it, you know, drawing and whatnot. But I've followed my dad around for years and years, and ever since I can remember, you know, here at Muirfield Village. He did this golf course. We opened in 74. He started the design in 72. So that would have put me about 10 years old at the time. And I followed him around. And I listened and I watched, and he'd ask my opinion as I grew up. And it's just, I felt like for me it was a learned skill. I love the work. Matter of fact, you did mention I had my own design group. I have my own design jobs, but I've always worked under the Nicholas Design Company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so my dad and I have been a partner on a lot of jobs. And I can't tell you how amazed I am with his ability to see things, just like you were explaining. You know, I oftentimes get caught up in minutiae and not, you know, as they say, see a tree through the forest. Well, he seems to be seeing a project from 20 and 30,000 feet really, really well. And he's got such a creative mind. And I've tried to just listen and learn best I can, because I don't think there's anybody better than him in the business. And it's really been a lot of fun, not just, you know, creating something that's going to be here well beyond my lifetime, but more importantly for me to be able to work with my dad.
A couple of questions about that business. Number one, I had a friend who was up at the Greenbrier last weekend, and I asked him, and he did not know the answer. There was that project that was going on with Trevino and Palmer and Player and your dad, all yep. four designing that. And with Arnold's passing, I'm wondering, where does that project stand now?
Arnold will have his design, his head design guy will be there and interact with Gary Lee and my dad now. So Arnold's input indirectly will still be there, and they're continuing on with that project.
And when one has a contract with the Jack Nicklaus Design Company, how much of a hands-on situation do they get from your dad?
If anybody has ever been part of that process, they'll know that it's complete hands-on with my dad. A lot of guys will just lend their name to a job. My dad would be the antithesis of that. He is... he loves it. He loves getting out there. He loves getting muddy. He loves being creative. He loves sharing ideas and thoughts with the developer and engineers. And he's out there with the guys that are pushing the dirt, that are sitting on the bulldozers, our design guys, which he's assembled an amazing, talented group of design associates and coordinators. And as a group, we kind of put our heads together, Dad being our leader, and he is completely hands-on. And, you know, I was talking about it with my mom today. My dad will promise, you know, one level, but always tries to over-deliver on that promise. That's just the way he's wired. And literally, he is out there, you know, a lot.
Jack Nicklaus II is our guest, taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. Get you out of here with a couple of questions about where you are right now at Muirfield Village. I saw you earlier this week in the ceremony with Greg Norman, and I really love all the things that they do up at that tournament at the Memorial. Can you just describe how special a place? You mentioned that it was an early design. It was 1974, but it seems to have a very special place in the heart of your father and your family. Can you describe the feeling Muirfield Village has for you?
It's a home away from home. Mom and Dad, when I think about it, it's incredible what they have created here when you think about the age. So 1968, my dad and three friends, there's four that founded the club here: Pamble Savick, Ivor Young, Bob Hogan, my dad. They were at Augusta National during one of the competitions there. They were sitting at a lunch table together, and they said, you know what, we really should try to do something like this for our hometown back in Columbus, Ohio. Let's give back to Columbus, something that's been so special to our lives. So anyway, they bought this property in 1968. My dad is 28 years old at the time. I have a son that's 27 right now. It's just, for me, it's unbelievable that, you know, he could have that foresight to, you know, get a piece of property and try to create something, give it back to his hometown. Well, he went on, and this golf course was really the first golf course built as a stadium-type golf course. His membership, the first 10 members, honorary members, he went to Japan. He got an Asian member. He got a black member. He got a female member. He tried to be as diverse as he could well before anybody talked about diversity. He's doing this as a 32-year-old young man. And of course now here we are, 40 some years later, and he's created a tournament that the best players in the world come to. It's played on a facility that is second to none, Muirfield Village Golf Club. And the players love coming here because I think my mom and dad took what they've learned throughout the years of traveling around the tour, and they've implemented it here. They've got, great child care services. They have, how they handle the players coming in and coming out. They make it as easy as they can for these guys to perform at their best level. And going beyond that, giving back to the community, there's over 100 local charities that benefit from the tournament each year. From inception, we've given close to $27 million. This year, we'll shell out about $2.5 million to the lion's share going to Nationwide Children's Hospital. So there's so many good things. It's not just golf. We're saving children's lives. And it's something that mom and dad have created. And again, I don't know if I mentioned, but honoring greats of the past. We honored Greg Norman this year, and Greg gave a wonderful talk yesterday about growing up and learning the game of golf through reading my dad's books, as a matter of fact, 55 Ways to Play Golf and Golf My Way, the two books that he received from his father, I think, when he was 15 years old. And there's so many little stories that I could tie into. I can go on and on, but it's a very, very special place.
All right, let's get out of here with the most important question about Muirfield Village. You're old enough to remember the old international that was at Castle Pines in Colorado.
Sure.
And that golf club was famous for one thing and one thing only, and that was its milkshakes. And lately, I'm hearing a lot of smack being talked about the brilliance of the Muirfield Village milkshake.
It's really good.
Putting all bias aside, which is the better milkshake?
Well, I actually played in the international for a couple of years, several years back before electricity. And
there was enough electricity in the skies out there.
But anyway, there's always been a fun competition. Actually, that they do a player poll. And one of the questions is, where are the best milkshakes on tour? And one and two went back and forth for many years between Castle Pines in Colorado and here at Muirfield Village Golf Club. And my vote goes to Muirfield Village in the Memorial Tournament. I actually had one 2 days ago. My wife's all over me. I had a little heart procedure a couple weeks ago, so I'm eating so much lettuce I'm going to turn into a manatee, I think. But I had a Buckeye milkshake, which is the chocolate and peanut butter, and they added a little bit of malt and just the richest, creamiest ice cream, and it was good. That was a treat. I hope she's not listening to this this interview because she'll know that I eat a milkshake.
He is Jack Nicklaus II. Jackie, great guy. And when we return, he's caddied in major championships, Ryder Cups, and is now in the bag for one of the brightest up-and-coming players in the world. David Woosley takes dead aim at Sam Burns' outstanding year that ended with the brand-new PGA Tour card. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone. BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Hey there, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. David Woosley, Wooz, is a longtime friend of the show and has been a professional caddy for more than three decades. Currently, he's on the bag for one of the brightest up-and-coming stars in the world of golf, Sam Burns. David, before we start talking about Sam and the great year that you guys had and what's ahead for you two, especially in the not-too-distant future, I want to hit on a couple of things. We talked early on in the year after you spent a round of golf. I think it was at the Honda. The final round of the Honda was Sam playing with Tiger Woods. And I remember talking with you at the time, and I said, well, what kind of condition is his game in? And you said, well, you can see some of it, but there's still a long way to go. Based on what you saw at the Honda and what we're now seeing, how big is that distance? How big is that transformation from that part of the year until now?
Well, I mean, I think it's monumental because at the Honda, just for instance, Joe LaCava is a friend of mine, Tiger's caddy, and I was asking him during the round, you know, what's your schedule? And he literally said, I don't know. And I think at that time they'd only played a few tournaments. And they weren't sure, you know, what his body could take. And so they were just kind of going week to week. Also, during his play, Tiger's play, I got the feeling like the last three or four holes, you know, he was being aggressive at some pins just to see if he could do it. Meaning, you know, he's under the gun. There was a lot of attention there, obviously. And I know the next to last par three, he hit it in the water. But I don't know. I just really admired what he was doing. I thought he was trying to go right at that pin, you know, water be damned type thing. And so he's just been making, you know, great progress, and obviously, and culminating in a terrific win. And on top of that, excuse me. I feel like you know, this is just a great thing for the tour, and I'm going to tell Sam Burns it's a great thing for him because, you know, Sam has big aspirations. He wants to be a top 10 player. He wants to win majors, and, you know, I think he's already done well around Tiger, and if this is, you know, the last 4 or 5 years of Tiger's, you know, powerful career, then Sam Burns is going to be a part of that. This is the first few years of his career, and hopefully his dreams will, you know, come true.
Looking back on this year, if you were to ask Sam where it ranked, how big of a highlight in his golfing life do you think it is that he got to play 18 holes of golf with Tiger Woods?
Well, I mean, first of all, 18 holes on basically Tiger's home track. I mean, that's not his home course, but he lives in the area. This is Florida, of course. And when we teed off, you know, both guys had an outside chance to win, maybe. I don't remember how far back we were. I think we were in seventh place or something like that, tied with Tiger. And so, you know, all systems are on go big time, and Sam, you know, played great. And so I couldn't tell you how high it is, but it still has to be in the top three, and I don't know what two or three would be.
Now, rumor has it that walking off that first tee, your man looked at Tiger and said, isn't it great that all these people showed up to see me? Is that true?
That is true, and I didn't know that until, like, the next day. there's a picture, yeah, in the paper, and you can see Johnny LaCava was behind Tiger and Sam, and I was about 10 paces behind, and I saw him chuckling, and I thought that was a good sign because I really believe that Tiger Woods likes to talk, you know, when he competes. I told Sam that Tiger would communicate, but you kind of had to you had to be the one to initiate it, and I guess that's the way things got started with a good chuckle.
David Woosley, Sam Burns caddy. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about your man a little bit. When last we were together was at Quail Hollow, and I believe y'all had a great Thursday and or Friday, you were right there in terms of getting enough money to where Sam could stay out on the big tour after Quail. It didn't go as planned, and so you had to finish out the season on the web.com, which, you know, look, no big deal. You were able to really move up your status. I think you finished fourth on the money list. But was that a period of disappointment for Sam, or was it one of those things that he said, ah, man, we gave it our best effort, but we're going to finish out strong on the web.com? I know you have a psychology degree. How did you play that with him?
You know, the answer to that question is both are true. You know, he was frustrated, and yet he was also saying, let's move on. You know, it's frustrating, particularly, for instance, at Tampa. I think we were in third place on the 16th tee, and anything, you know, top five, they would have gotten it done, and didn't get it done there, didn't get it done in Charlotte. And so, obviously, we needed to go on the web. Sam finished fourth, I guess, total money when you add the web.com final four, but we just kind of stumbled in there and finally decided to, you know, go home for a little bit and get some rest. But he finished second in the regular season, and we feel really good about that. So we're looking forward to next week, which is Tampa.
Now, talk to me a little bit about the way it works in terms of seeding, because not all exemptions on the PGA Tour are equal. Because you finished second in the regular season or fourth in the overall money list, you guys are pretty much exempt into everything that you could possibly be exempt into, yes?
Yeah, until the end of this calendar year. That's my understanding, is, you know, that you have to, there's a reshuffle after, I don't know if it's five or eight tournaments or something like that. And you have to play to a certain standard. And I'm assuming that we got to do that the rest of the year. But, you know, if Sam just plays his normal game, that's not going to be a concern. But he's certainly not taking anything for granted. So, the only thing I know is I guess they have two. The winner of the web.com regular season, the fellow from Korea, and then the winner of the overall money, both of those guys are fully exempt, including TPC in Jacksonville, which is a big deal. But other than that, you know, we've just got to keep playing good golf, and, you know, Sam's a good player, and so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, David, as I look at your results in the middle of summer, starting at the 1st of July, I mean, T11, 3rd, T14, T7, third. You guys got on a really nice roll there in the summer, and then it's like you said, it's almost like you got to August and your kid just kind of ran out of gas. Is there such a thing as, even though he's a young guy, is there such a thing of maybe playing too much?
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely. I've worked for a lot of young guys, and you know, they're all guilty of that, thinking that just because they're, you know, 20 whatever, that they're bulletproof and not. But it doesn't show up until Sunday, and if you do it, especially if you're doing really well, because it's the mental stuff that kind of seems to crumble first. But obviously, if you get on a regular schedule, 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and then take a week or two off, you can do it. But I think Chip Beck was, he was a great player, and we played, and he was playing great, and we played the U.S. Open in San Francisco back in the day, and I remember, you know, this was his sixth tournament in a row, and you just knew it wasn't going to go well, and we missed the cut, and I think that's exactly what happened to Sam. When you're going at it full bore the way he does, you don't even allow the thought that you need some rest to come in there, because he felt like that he needed to do that to secure his spot. And once our spot was secured, it's natural to kind of have a letdown. So that's what happened.
So your schedule going forward, you say you're back in action next week. Did you learn along the way, okay, Sam, we're going to be out for 3 weeks tops at a time, or is it 4 weeks? What do you think his limits are?
I think he's a smart guy, and he wants to be, you know, able to bring everything he has every time he tees up, which is what Tiger has talked about for, you know, his whole playing life. So I would imagine that we'll play three, maybe four in a row if we have to. And by the way, we're going to play Napa, and then there's 2 weeks off that we're not going to play overseas. And then there is four in a row. I think it's Jackson, Mississippi, Las Vegas, Mexico, and then the island.
Right.
And he'll be good for all of those. I'm 100% confident of that. But you wouldn't want to go four in a row, take a week off, three in a row, stuff like that. I mean, that just beats you up.
David Woosley is Sam Burns' caddy. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Want to ask you about the Ryder Cup real quick. We've talked about it before. You were with Chip for the War on the Shore. And as I watch preparation getting ready for this week, I always think of questions for you. And the preparation for a caddy, it's different for the Ryder Cup. And we were swapping messages off air. You say in some ways it's a little easier because, unlike every other event, you've got 11 other caddies and you guys are sort of pooling your resources.
Yeah, so, I mean, some excuses if you get in a room with the rest of the guys, particularly the ones that you're close to, and, you know, just verify that all these numbers are correct, you know, looking at slopes and landing areas and see if that, if there's an impact there, if there's, you know, so, I mean, you should have everything and be completely comfortable, you know, the first competitive round. So, you know, and then on top of that, the players, I think they've mentioned that on TV recently, you know, that they're not exactly, at least the first of the week, going at it because they're tired. And so that's perfect. They might have just played nine holes on Tuesday. I don't know. Some of them up, probably. But anyway, that's the perfect opportunity to have, you know, have 3 or 4 hours out there by yourself with other caddies, you know, looking at strategic placement of shots and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's easier in that sense, and but there's definitely a lot of energy there. The very first tee, the very first day, it feels like a heavyweight fight and just people screaming. I mean, it's hard to stay calm.
Dumb caddy question coming up right here. When you're out doing your measurements and whatever for the golf course, every golf course in the world has things measured out 250, 200, 150, 100. When you look at a hole, where are places that you look to that I need to get a measurement from here? What is something that you see visually that tells you, I better go over here and get a measurement from this point? Are there certain landmarks you look for on a hole?
Well, here's kind of my dumb answer, which is I look for everything. I don't, you know, that's just the way I do it. And I try to spend as much time on the course as possible, meaning, I mean, just because I have all the yardage, that's a great thing. But I need to be on the course watching other players, you know, how the ball lands in the fairway, on the green, stuff like that. And so I have yardage books that I've had for, you know, five or 10 years. And, you know, surprisingly enough, at some point, you know, you'll find a number that you, wow, I don't have that number. And strangely enough, and I can't remember where it was, but it might have been Boise where somebody hit a ball so far left of the other fairway, and they had a number from a sprinkler head in the opposite fairway to the front of the green in your fairway. And I was thinking, I don't have that one. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's like a parallel fairway. You missed it so bad, you got into the other fairway, and you needed that number, and this caddy had it, and I didn't have it.
I don't know what that says about that caddy's confidence in his man that he's measuring things from other fairways.
Seriously.
On the bag for Sam Burns, a seriously good pro caddy and a good guy, David Woosley, my man Woos. Hey, I'd also like to thank Jack Nicklaus II for his time this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Hey, weather-wise, well, be honest with you, better Sunday than Saturday to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.